welcome to AMO Kenzoku, episode 71. We are a group of four Bubblegum Crisis Boomer Otaku who wanted an excuse to talk about anime, manga, and any other related subjects we find interesting. The Kenzoku are...
Hey y'all, I'm Mike.
I'm Dylan.
Hey, I'm Nick.
And I'm this evening's host, Sam. This episode is being recorded on June 12th of 2025. And today we are going to be talking about the 1979 film House.
Seven.
Yes, there we go. Let's get started. Hashin. Okay, so before we get into House, Fanime was just happened over the Memorial Day weekend, which is something that Mike and I go to every year, anime convention in San Jose. Figure it would be interesting to get kind of our observations, a kind of a report. I don't have anything specific to mention about it because, there were no Japanese guests that I cared about. They had some VA, I think at least one VA, Japanese VA. Is that right, Mike?
Yeah, I think they had a couple of Japanese VAs. I'm not sure. They didn't have any guests that I was all that interested in either. If I were interested in older dubs, apparently the guest they did have would have been solid for that, but...
Which was who? Do you remember the name?
I honestly don't remember.
Okay, yeah, that shows how much we don't care. One thing that was interesting is they had a VTuber guest, which I kind of regret not going to the panel just because, just to see what it was about. But it was a Doki Bird, so they were there attending virtually.
That's actually a name I recognize because
she
participated in the what's known as the Sage Am Slam, which was kind of this big content creator like group fighting game tournament hosted by FGC content creator Sage Am. She's actually very good. In general. Yeah, she was surprisingly good. She opted to not attend the live finals only because I think she wanted to retain her anonymity, which is 100% valid. I think that's why a lot of VTubers get into that side of content creation, is they want to connect to a community without, you know, having their face out there. So totally understand that. I don't know if that's the reason. I just feel like that makes sense. But
Yeah,
I'm actually quasi familiar with her because of that. So
yeah, I had known the name, I think mostly because of she has an interesting backstory. There's like a drama surrounding her. Not that she caused the drama, but like, you know, she was from I think she's former Niji Sanji talent before all that stuff kind of exploded. And she went indie and all that stuff. Anyways, I won't spend any time going into that. But anyways, seems interesting. She was there. There were also a lot of, C-list VTubers roaming the halls on these like little remote operated robot, you know, wheels with a screen on the top, like basically an iPad on top.
So they're attending by proxy.
Yeah, there's just people I've never seen or heard of before. Yeah, with a handler basically attending as they just drove around and talked to people on the floor, which is kind of interesting. Not my thing, but
different. Like it was the cheaper but and also weirder version of the surrogate from Arrested Development.
I don't remember that part, but
oh gosh, see, when the dad was in jail and he had the surrogate who was outside who just walked around with a camera that was on his head and would just repeat anything that the dad said.
Yes, this was a cheaper, more technologically advanced version of that, although there was a person involved too, so maybe it was actually worse. I don't know.
Yeah,
but yeah, you had the whole iPad with the character on it, and I don't know. It seemed awkward. I tried not to make eye contact. Mike, what was your experience like? Anything interesting to mention?
I was mostly meeting up with, you know, people that I've met up with before, old friends and such, and had a pretty chill con. Like, was your sense that things felt subdued and maybe attendance was a little down this year? I'm not sure about the parts of the con you went to, but that seemed yes. like the impression it, of the people I was talking to.
Yeah, that I got that exact impression as just walking the hall. Like, I think I went to no panels this year. I think I did the same thing as I did last year. And I just kind of roamed the dealer's hall, artist alley, and gaming, just watching things. And it was definitely less attended. Like, feeling-wise, it was less attended than last year. It didn't feel as crowded. Artist alley is always slammed, so, like, that, I don't know, that never changes. It's not a good gauge, but, like, other areas, like walking the floor, the area around the convention center, like just nothing seemed quite as packed as previous years.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much some of that was things spreading back out to the former Fairmont now that it had a few things in there.
That's true.
That makes it a little harder to judge, but it still felt light to me.
Yeah, I would love to get attendance numbers from somebody to see how well it did. Because I have these general questions about the health of conventions in general, just with anime and manga being what it is and kind of the culture around it being a little bit more mainstream, like maybe this isn't as necessary. Like, the stuff in Dealer's Hall is not as much anymore the rare finds from Japan that you know, this is like, it used to be the only place you could get some of this stuff, and now it's like, well, the merch from Japan is like acrylic keychains at best, and like most of the stuff in there is like a bootleg merch, basically, like unlicensed merchandise.
So modern Sanmei stuff.
Yeah, except it's way more out in the open, and at least this stuff is trying to do something original. Like, there'll be like t-shirts with characters on them. Like,
oh, I see. Yeah.
Like, you'll have like Sasuke and it'll be like saying, touch my booty or something like that. You know,
that's
the kind of stuff that they have in there.
You mean fan art, unquote.
Yes.
Fanfic, the merchandise.
Yes, exactly. And there's a lot of original merch, which I do enjoy. I think I said this last year, but, and there's, you know, people that come and like, they just take their artwork and they turn it into clothing and things like that. There were a lot of those, and I really love to see those. I think that's really cool. But yeah, I don't know. It's kind of sad. Anything else, Mike, to add?
No, apparently they were scrambling because one of their guests canceled like a day before con, which always messes things up. But
yeah, it looks like Damon Mills. I don't know who that person is, but I'm sure they're very well known or something.
Yeah, I've never heard of them. That sucks either way, because I'm sure there were people who knew who that was and probably were coming just for that.
Possibly, yeah. I don't know. I feel like with the younger demographic, it's almost never just about like a singular guest anymore. I think a lot of it is, like you said, where you see people congregating, like Artist Alley. Definitely is a massive draw. Even back when I was still going, like, the Artist Alley was definitely always bustling. It wasn't the jam-packed, you know, zoo that I think, I see the photos of AX's. Yeah. I mean, AX is a different beast altogether, right? But just, I don't wish, I mean, the fact that the CO2 concentration in Artist Alley was measurably higher due to the amount of density of people is just, you know, is a testament to its popularity. But
it's Artist Alley is definitely always the most crowded one for sure. We'll see how this trend continues. I'm always keeping an eye on this stuff. I enjoyed convention culture when we were all going. Nowadays, it seems like if you want to see the good stuff, you got to go to AX or SakuraCon. I don't know. Fanime's never been a big guest one, so maybe I shouldn't be So
I don't know. I feel like it was for a good while, and then, you know, I think it heavily derailed after COVID.
Yeah. Well, I just mean, like, guest wise, like, they had Yamaga every year, and he was a big get, right? But as the years went on, it was less so. And then, especially after 2008, when they brought all the Grand Lagoon people, downhill from there. You were saying, Mike?
I lost track. Oh, I was thinking that it's kind of a bummer for the current generation that, you know, the 24-hour con culture that always used to make Fanime so special isn't present anymore.
Oh, yeah, that's true. And I really don't like the kind of metal detector things. They're not really metal detectors, but they're kind of the porno machines, that, like, the whatever, the millimeter wave stuff, I think. Because I go in there with my laptop, and, like, every time they have to, you know, okay, stop, put your bag down, go through again. Now let me look at your bag. Like, this is really annoying.
That's interesting. Your laptop must set it off. I only have set it off once in 2 years, and that was when I had my water bottle right next to my power bank, so maybe it looked like something. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely because of my laptop. It was the same way last year. It's just annoying. Like, I just kind of know the routine. But for most people, I think they just walk through. So it's more of a personal gripe than in certain situations.
Honestly, whatever. I'm reasonably impressed that even people in cosplay can mostly just walk through. Like, that's an achievement.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the technology in, like, vinyl work and, like, plastics work is really accelerated from cosplay over the last decade.
Oh yeah, I mean, the great thing about cosplay these days is, like, there is the middle has really filled out in terms of quality, where, like, you can just go online and buy a costume, which is and it'll look decent, right? But PSA, please, if you're doing that, iron your costume.
When it's got 90 degree creases all across, yeah. Like. That level of minimal effort is a little egregious, I agree.
So people did not heed your request for them to do that at last Fanime, and people were still not having ironed their outfits?
Nope, they still did not hear me, and they still did not iron their outfits. I mean, the people that did, I couldn't tell. I'm judging you all. But I mean, it's nice that they can do that. I really appreciate that things are to the point where you can just go on whatever Taobao and buy a $20, you know, costume, creases or not. I think that's it helps the vibe of the con, I think, of, like, a lot more people in being in cosplay. I think that's cool.
Yeah, I think it helps that lower end cosplay feels like something you can do again just casually, rather than, like, how intimidating and professional things had gotten, that the barrier to entry seemed too high.
Yeah, like before it was like, oh, let's do a group cosplay, and it's like, well, okay, that you're signing up for like 6 months of work, or realistically maybe a week of work at the beginning and then 4 months of work in 1 week at the end. But like nowadays it's like, oh, let's just go buy these costumes and go to the convention, and that's cool.
Just a couple of things I was curious, because I just loaded up the website looking at their various panels and things, and I think some stuff is kind of interesting. They have all, like, the random ones, but, like, the ones that are categorized as manga and webcomics, there's only two. And one was the Ultimate Yuri Manifesto, and the other one was Yaoi Campfire Stories.
Yeah.
Good to know that some things never change.
yeah. Which...
But it's kind of interesting. It's like, oh, okay, right, you know. I mean, I'm not surprised at theirs, but it seems kind of funny to me, too. It's like, oh, those are the only two that were really, like, categorized as a, like, a manga thing.
Yeah, there's, they seem like they're very creative, but it's definitely not my thing. But at least we have, like, the con has moved past the, like, how to pick up girls' panels and stupid stuff like that.
Yep, that's true. They do have some other ones that sound, some of them, like, if I had been, I'd been like, all right, maybe I'll go check this out. Like, you know, there's a whole panel that was called Waluigi Time. So, you know, how do you lose with that? That one just sounds like a winner.
I do love that stuff. Even if it's not my thing, yeah. I love that there's this
I
kind
think
of thing.
That, that's something about fanime that I hope never changes, is that the amount of actual fan panels. Like, that's something mm-hmm. that has sorely been completely squeezed out of AX. AX is so industrial, right? It's like,
oh, yeah.
to have a booth at AX is like in the six-figure range, is what I hear.
Dang.
Like, it's only for serious, you know, anime businesses now, and it's... That's cool for the spectacle and all, but not my thing. So
yeah, and that's a fair point of a thing that is cool on Fanime, is that like there's a bunch of like weird random panels. Like there's the one I saw that was like in my Y2K area where someone did like an hour long panel of, you know, historical panel of what fandom was like in the 90s and 2000s, aka AMO. Kenzo through the podcast done live, you know, talking about how do we get our uncensored anime? Uranus mm-hmm. and Neptune are cousins? Wait, that's not a jelly donut.
That is definitely a panel that has been done before.
Oh, yeah. And some of them are certainly like annual or every few years mm-hmm. the person runs the same thing back or whatever. But I think that is the cool thing about Fanime, even if it's not super... Even if these panels aren't like super well attended or anything, the fact is that people can have these panels there and do that sort of stuff and be like, hey, cool. I have a panel on para dancing. Cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think next year I'm going to make a point to go to some of these, even if I think they make me cringe. I will force myself to see what it's like.
Do it for the podcast.
Yeah. Do it for the content. Yeah.
Do it for the content.
Yeah. Yeah, I've just stayed away from that stuff for so long. I think it's overdue for me to take a peek. And I do, in hindsight, regret not going to the Doki Bird panel just to, again, see what it's like. Not like I was doing other important things, so.
Yeah.
Okay. House. Japanese horror film, comedy horror film. From 1977. I bought this on iTunes and it was categorized as comedy, and I did not realize that initially. Okay, that was a surprise. I will say generously, I would try and explain the plot, but I really don't think it matters. Like, some girls go to a house and a bunch of them die. That's it. I guess that maybe that's a spoiler, but I don't think that spoils anything. So avant-garde is how I would describe this movie in a generous way. Mike, as the one with the most experience with this movie, how would you describe this movie?
I am trying to find the right words for it too. I guess I would say it feels very like postmodern and 70s in, you know, not the like 70s New Hollywood stuff, gritty stuff, but like the 70s kind of kitsch that you saw in commercials and TV kind of stuff. You can definitely get the sense that the director had worked in art films and then commercials, and then this was his first movie.
Yeah, so I didn't know any of that. I went in totally blind watching this movie, and I'm just, you know, looking at Wikipedia just before we started recording and seeing some of this stuff where, like, they basically had a script, but, like, no storyboards, like, and they just kind of did whatever they want while they filmed the movie. It just...
Yeah, that tracks, given
the
pacing.
The behind the scenes on this movie is as wild, at least, as the movie itself.
Yeah. The characters have names like Gorgeous and Fantasy and Kung Fu.
That again feels like a commercial aspect to me. Like, you would just, you know, the throwaway names you would give characters that are never actually expressed to anyone but kind of quickly designate their type.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, at first I was thinking, sorry, just going to the names, I thought I was mishearing because I'm like, what are these names? And I had to start looking at subtitles. I'm like, oh, no, these are the character names. okay, that's just what it is. And then how, like, the one that eats a lot is named Mac.
Yeah.
And I was like, is that short for McDonald's? And it's like, it's short for Mac as in stomach. I'm like, wow, that's quite
wait,
the...
Wait, what? Really? I missed that part. Oh,
yeah.
Is that...
Yeah. That's the explanation. That's not back creating, because I was certainly wondering if it was short for McDonald's.
Too. Yeah, that's what I was just like, oh,
it's
it
like,
must be
McDonald's. How long had McDonald's been in Japan at this point?
long enough.
It might have also been that Toho said, no, you can't call it after McDonald's. So they're like, Stomach, we got it. I liked one of the review summaries in from the wiki says, Slate called it, equal parts brilliant, baffling, ridiculous, and unwatchable. And I'm like, yeah, that feels about right.
Yeah, I was about to disagree until they got to the end, and I was like, okay, now you've got the full set, yes. Unwatchable must be included in there. I mean, I wasn't bored, I will say. But I was certainly not engaged. It was...
Yeah, I think that was partly due to just, like, the acting quality was, you know, not great, to say the least.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
obviously these are all...
Many of the actors were girls that he had also worked with in commercials. Shock.
Sure. So, yeah. So first-timers in far as doing, like, long-form, like, filming, right? So that's fine.
Also, apparently, like, they had trouble taking direction, so in order to get them to change mood and such, he would play the soundtrack on the set.
Okay.
Because he already had the soundtrack by this point, because, like, okay, so strange story behind this movie number one, like, his assignment in 1975 or so was, okay, from write the Japanese, you know, answer to Jaws.
Yeah, I saw that on the wiki, and I was like, I don't see how they got there from that. That concept.
Well, that's because you're thinking like an adult, as he said in this interview. If you ask an adult to make an answer to Jaws, what you'll get is like a movie about a bear that attacks people. So I went and asked my 10-year-old daughter and got something actually interesting.
Okay.
So yeah, most of the like kills and other things in this movie are him like asking his daughter, so what would be scary for me to put in my movie? So
this
yeah,
is like
if
Axe Cop,
Axe Cop,
some
yeah.
of the you know stuff in the movie seems like something that came out of a deranged 10-year-old's imagination because it did.
Nick, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I think yeah, the statement Dylan read is more or less aligns with it. Like, I won't say that this was the most this is a completely unwatchable movie, but I feel like it starts really slow. It was tough for me to get on board with it. Once they got to the property, I'm like, okay, now it's going to be maybe interesting. And it was just kind of more bizarre and a little weird, but, you know, it was fine. And then the nickname started to finally make a little sense, a little questionable on why, like, you know, in her first, that's called like big action thing, Kung Fu's, had to disappear. That was a little odd, or it stayed that way the whole rest of the movie, and you
no
know,
reaction
was,
either.
Yeah, and she was, I mean, to her credit, she was the only character that actually did anything useful.
Yeah, I was gonna say, she was the only one that was actually useful. I watched this movie twice. I watched it a while ago.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I watched it again. I watched it again today. You know, I it is ridiculous, and it also is, it's kind of weird and fun and charming and stupid and awful, and then you come back around to it. But yeah, Kung Fu, like, she's the only one who actually does anything useful. Was it Gari, the professor? I think she's the dumbest of all. How is she the professor?
Yeah.
I don't understand. She, like, keeps trying to be like, oh, well, you know, like, I'd have this theory about what it might be, but I'm not sure. And if I told Fantasy, like, she would pass out. So I'm not going to say it. And it's like, what the heck? You've already had four of your friends disappeared. Like, why not give your theory out if you're so smart about this?
I also like that everybody's like, oh, Mac, you love to eat so much. And it's like, I kind of, you know, you think like, oh, she'd be like fat or something. It's like, she looks like all the rest of them.
Yeah, she's a pretty normal looking, but maybe by 1970s standards, maybe she was like, I don't know, 2 kilograms more than the other. So she yeah. was yeah. nicknamed the fat one.
Yeah. The first time I watched it with my wife, and we went in just with like, okay, Mike said that we should watch this, and it's supposed to be a really weird kind of comedy horror thing from 1977. That was about all I knew. And we watched it, and she was like, I'm not watching any other movies that Mike recommends. That was her review of the film.
Okay, to be fair, there are movies I recommend and say this is really good, and there are movies that I recommend because I want to see other people's reactions to them, and this is definitely okay. in the latter category.
Okay, fair enough. I think some of her complaints with it was like, she's like, these characters, like, they're literally the most one-dimensional by name and everything there.
Yes.
You know, there is the crazy nonsense. And she was like, yeah, Mac. She's like, Mac is not fat. She's the same as everyone else. Like,
yeah.
That, and, you know, it's a trip of a film. And I don't think she's not quite as much into those sorts of things if they don't also carry something good where that's more cohesive, where actually she hasn't. But I think that she would definitely be more into, like, Perfect Blue, which is a crazy trip mm-hmm. of a film, and we still don't know what happened, but it also makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I could even enjoy a movie with, like, no plot if, like, there's enough stuff going on that's kind of interesting that gives me room to, like, think. I kind of like Perfect Blue, but I would take even less than Perfect Blue, right? Like, just neat stuff happening, visually very interesting, whereas this one feels like very experimental, where they're just like doing random stuff, the transitions, like the all the different ways they went between scenes, like some of that, especially in the beginning of the movie, was actually I thought was kind of interesting. Like I thought they were doing neat things that I'd never seen before. Now, like, I'm not a movie connoisseur, so like maybe this was kind of in the zeitgeist at the time, but I don't know, I thought that was neat to see that kind of experimentation, but the rest of it didn't carry any of that kind of interesting stuff with it.
I agree with that. Yeah, I definitely think there was, and it's one of those things that does make it, I think it's one of those things that has given it some length, where it's like, you can kind of be like, this part of the movie, like, doesn't appeal to me, but this segment here is kind of cool. Like, mm-hmm. I really like the segment where Fanta is daydreaming about getting on the horse with her teacher and like going off. It's like this little like minute long thing, and it's got like little like subtitles yeah. in the side, and it's just like, it's just, it's pretty hilarious, and like it fits, and then you're done with it.
I did like the early, not the hijack, but one area of the movie I thought was kind of well put together and actually kind of cool how they executed it was kind of when they were traveling to the house, like, you know, their various modes of travel and like the kind of, you know, hodgepodge sets that they put together for. I thought the set, like, utilization and design was clever, and I would say one of the areas of the movie mm-hmm. I enjoyed, just because it's like you can tell what little budget they had and how they really tried to make it work, and I respected that. But especially like when she's telling the story about her aunt, and like it goes back to like the grainy black and white film.
Oh yes,
and that little story, right? That was one of, in my opinion, one of the better parts, because it sets it up, right? Like, oh, yes. So this aunt went through some stuff. Her trauma is pretty real, and it's like really, you know, and especially when the movie came out, right, 77, it wasn't that far removed from the war. So I thought that was kind of a cool setup for it, and then kind of like, you know, alluded to what was going to come. And then also just like the random like background characters, like there was like a nun and like a priest with like wearing like Western, like, you know, priest clothing with a cross. I'm like, that's interesting and clever. And then just the cat just always there, the omnipresent cat.
Yeah.
So
the evil cat.
Yeah, I think that was one of the, like, I would say the higher points of the movie for me.
Yeah, I agree. I was actually going to mention too that the flashback kind of thing, I thought that was actually very creative. The way that it felt like a little clumsy, but I thought it was really interesting the way that like they're watching this thing that we know they're not actually watching. It felt a little bit like it reminded me of in Millennium Actress. They do this thing where like they're in her memories and as kind of observers, and I thought kind of got a little bit of that from there, which was neat. And you mentioning the sets also reminded me of, I liked how when they get out of the bus at the final stop, there's that like backdrop behind them, and then like it pans, like it pulls back, and like you see it's just a little
wall,
a board. I thought that was pretty creative.
I was just thinking of a new movie that made a good amount of money that kind of did some similar stuff, which was the Barbie movie, with their transitions into and out of Barbie land, where it does this very like weird kind of surreal in all these differing modes of transportation.
Oh. But that movie had what, 9-figure budget.
I'm not saying it's the same. I'm just like, oh, but it, I just, as you said that, I was like, oh, it actually kind of was a similar kind of vibe, and it worked well there too, because you were transitioning between two completely different worlds.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. That's kind of where this movie was, I don't know, you could maybe say it was a pioneer. Again, like, I don't know if you guys have seen the meme, like a guy who has only seen Boss Baby watching his second movie ever saying, boy, I'm getting a lot of Boss Baby vibes. I don't want to go off too far on that, like giving too much credit to this movie, because I don't know what else was out there, but like it feels a little bit like a trailblazer in some of these cases. Like,
I hadn't actually heard that. That's a good meme. We'll definitely use that one. Yeah, but it's hard to say. But it is such a weird experimental movie that I'm sure there was a bunch of stuff that probably hadn't really been done together that way as a film, and that's why you can say, oh, these little segments here, those actually worked and were cool. And like, I'm sure that film people, if they watch it and they're like, oh, actually that's a cool idea, I can steal that or use that as part of a thing or something. And like, rather than being like, well, I'm gonna take that and then I'm gonna throw it in with all this other insane things and the plot and the non-plot and everything else and go that way. So
yeah, I think that it came out in 1977 puts this movie in an interesting place. I don't know enough Japanese cinema to really date it in that context, but as far as international insane comedies, I'm thinking like Monty Python and the Holy Grail came out in 75 and Airplane came out in 80, just to put it neatly in between those two for level of kind of surreal craziness.
I mean, if it was a big movie, the chances are it made it to Japan, or at least to the influential people, right, who saw that stuff.
Well, I know Monty Python made it to Japan because like half of the actors who have played Lupin over the years were dub voices for different members of Monty Python.
I did not know that.
So let's hear. So I'll just segue into this forcibly here, which is that I thought it was kind of an interesting, weird thing in the movie, in that Oshare, Gorgeous, ended up not being like the main kind of heroine person. She just got eaten by the house too, and it really was Kung Fu that was the only one that, as we said, actually did anything and was kind of like the actual action acting person.
I agree that Oshare definitely, I would think that was an interesting surprise. Well, she basically fell to the house relatively quickly, actually, into the movie. But I actually don't think that, I agree that Kung Fu was the only one doing anything, but I think the actual main character for the rest of it was actually, was Fanta.
Yeah.
I think because so much of she was the only one that kind of saw everything as it happened. Like, she saw all of the horror stuff from the beginning, from the get-go, and she somehow survived. She was the last survivor till the very, very end when she, you know, whatever, passes out and now, like, possessed Oshada's arms. So I think for the good chunk of the movie, it's actually Fanta is, like, the main character, so to speak.
Yeah, I think I agree with that.
And it's so weird because it totally sets you up for not that, with Oshare being the one that it starts on, and you get the whole family history and new mom and...
Yeah, like, yeah. The whole messaging was weird. Like, I don't know what their intent was with this. Like, I'm totally fine with the plot not having, like, a clear and direct, you know, predictable ending. Like, oh, it's actually ending with a twist. Like, mm-hmm. You know, because in my opinion, the contrived, like... pokey ending would have been the teacher made it in time, and the aunt, you know, sees him as the her like old flame returning, and she becomes satisfied and is, you know, is purified or whatever, and she leaves, and then they all, whatever, survivors leave happily ever after, and Fanta goes off and galloping off on the back of the white horse, right? That would have been the contrived, air quotes, good ending.
Mm-hmm.
I think we got more or less the worst possible result, because not only are they all dead, but but it's heavily implied there's going to be one more victim, right? With the stepmom.
Oh, yeah.
But that whole storyline, like, was unnecessary. Like, if that, they're going to do that, like, I don't even know why they bothered introducing her as a character, because she really didn't do anything of consequence. She appeared at the beginning, appeared at the end, and that's it. So,
she was like, the rationale for getting them there, but I'm not sure that was necessary.
It was nice, like you say, Nick, that the teacher didn't come and save the day. Like, I was kind of watching the movie, and, you know, you watch his kind of journey there, which was kind of amusing, the way they did that whole thing. And you think, okay, finally he's going to come and save the day. And he doesn't. And I, like you say, I really appreciate that he didn't.
For sure.
And but
actually, I do have a question for everybody, because I'm not going to lie, I was starting to drift off a bit at the end of the movie. Did the teacher get turned into a pile of bananas?
Yes. As far as I can tell.
That's what I thought. Yeah. So I was like, did I misinterpret this? Was I actually falling asleep and dream this? Like, because at the end, I see the car and it's just filled with bananas. I'm like, did he turn into a pile of bananas?
Yeah, that's one of the less sensical parts of the movie that always has me going, what?
I think you've really achieved maximum movie if you're wondering whether or not what you saw in the movie is actually what you saw or not. That's pretty meta for this film.
They accomplished their goal, I would imagine, right? Some of that is to put you in that kind of state of hopefully not going to sleep, but like questioning what you're seeing. Did they really do that? Did I just see that? Yeah. And the stepmom didn't even acknowledge the car filled with bananas when she is stopped, because she can't go any further because of them.
Yeah, she's like in permanent Disney princess mode, right? Like, there's all the wind blowing. Yeah. like it's just,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, that was like literally her as a, she was caricaturized as that, right? So yeah, I thought the ending was actually okay. Like, the last thing I would have wanted after surviving this movie myself was for there to be some sort of contrived happy ending. Mm-hmm. Like, if everybody doesn't die, then I'm gonna be upset, and at least I got my wish. So
yeah, you weren't getting a contrived happy ending from a director who grew up in Hiroshima and lost most of his friends to the bomb.
Ah, I see. So there's his trauma.
Yeah, he was at least in part trying to, like, convey some of that abstract, uncaring, irrational horror to the generation that grew up completely post-war and post-war economic privation.
Right, they only really saw all of the benefits that came afterwards from a literal generation breaking their backs to recover a completely flattened country, so... I can understand that, like, especially now, the age I'm at now. Mm-hmm. I can definitely, not necessarily relate, but I can understand trying to, you know, convey those feelings to people that just cannot fathom it because they didn't experience it. So
right, like, if you want to be generous, like, the craziness of the movie is almost like desperately trying to make some connection to people he probably doesn't really understand, right? Like,
maybe that's why he couldn't direct, right, the
actresses.
Yeah, because they just didn't get, he's trying to convey, like, I need you to suffer more, and they're like, we don't understand how you want us to do this.
Yeah. He's driving himself mad, trying to, you kids. I mean, he seems, just judging him through the movie, I would guess that he's maybe a happy-ish guy. Like, they did a lot of silly stuff in that movie. But I don't know, maybe he's like Miyazaki and he's just extremely grumpy, but he manages to make whimsical things.
He definitely seems like less of an asshole than Miyazaki in his interviews, I'll say that much.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, Miyazaki's kind of gets the pass just because he almost single-handedly has carried the studio for, you know, four decades. So, you know, I think he gets the Walt Disney pass, right? Like, let's be real, Disney was no saint either. So,
also, it sounds like his set is a lot more fun to work on. Like, apparently one of the days he was, like, joking around with one of the, like, lighting crew and called out to them by name or something, and then lost, like, a screw from his sunglasses, so was finished the day, like, with half glasses, and then at the wrap party that evening, like, the lighting crew was 2 hours late and then showed up with the screw because no one had ever called them by name before.
Oh,
that's a cool story. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Again, this is me projecting, but I feel like as an individual that survived Hiroshima in 1945, your outlook in life is that there's so few people that can relate to that, right? You quite literally saw the worst thing that humanity could possibly do, and then you saw the literal greatest recovery of a nation, you know, in the modern era.
Yeah.
So I think I'm sure he has these massively conflicting feelings as an individual, right? Like, he's seen the worst atrocities of war, and he's also seen the greatest things that a community of humans trying to, you know, recover can do. And I'm sure that warped him, is that the right word? But that is, you know, those two things heavily influenced him as an adult, to like what he became as an adult. Yeah, shaped him, right? So I can imagine him being a very understanding person just because he's seen such terrible things, but also like being frustrated that people cannot see certain things a certain way that he can, because again, really, he's one of the few people that's lived to tell the tale, so to speak, right?
Yeah. So,
in that sense, you know, like, I don't think it's too big of a stretch to see some of that sensibility.
Yeah.
In the movie.
I really want to watch more of his work to see what direction he went in from here, because you see some of these like late 70s movies by people doing experimental stuff, and then they go in more conventional directions later. So, I don't know. I'm curious, especially because he did the 1984 live-action version of The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, which I keep meaning to watch but haven't yet.
Oh, well, I'm telling you now, you should watch it and then tell us about it. I thought it was interesting looking at the ending credits, how short they were.
Yeah.
I was like, I mean, I'm used to movies these days, yeah, where it's like a half hour of credits, right?
Yeah, true.
It was like 30 seconds.
You didn't have as many VFX artists, for one thing.
Yeah, like, yeah. Well,
he had access to the Toho VFX crew, but he wanted to do effects in camera and with his cameramen instead, because he thought they would fit the vibe he needed for the movie.
I did not like the soundstage filming for everything. That was one thing that, like, ignoring all the other kind of just weirdness that I'll just chalk up to experimentation, like, I don't know why they couldn't find a house to film in, for at least for the outside parts. It looked really bad to me.
Oh, with like the setting it up with their sets on the stage there rather than going to an actual location somewhere.
I would assume a house of that kind of architecture was basically impossible to find in Japan.
I figure, like, out in the countryside somewhere? Had to have been some. I don't know.
But that you could film in on whatever budget they made this is the question.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I like, there must have been some reason, because also, like, I don't think it was cheap to build these sets, right?
These sets and Toho sound stages weren't cheap. Like, apparently Toho largely couldn't afford to use them at the time, but he had a lot of experience on them because commercials could.
So maybe that's why he was just kind of going to what he was familiar with, like.
Yeah, that could be.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I'm curious, is there actually, like, a good, like, the making of this, like, film? Because I feel like that's a thing where you could have, like, a two-part, eight-hour-long thing on making of this movie.
Yeah, I haven't found... I haven't looked too hard. I'd like to find more than the 45-minute Criterion short that I've seen.
Oh, so there at least is something there. That's more than nothing, because I figure it's one of those things where a lot of stuff just wasn't recorded and carried down, because it's just kind of like, who cares, we're just making the thing.
Yeah, that's the source for a lot of this random stuff that I've been pulling out, is the Criterion interview with him.
I will say, just looking at his filmography, he released his last movie in 2019. Like, that's
what
heck of a long career. He filmed and finished it while he had stage 4 cancer. Like,
also, he wrote the script for it before House, at least the first draft.
Holy moly. I want to watch
the 2019 one. The 2017 one was the movie that he wanted to be his first movie but couldn't get anyone to make it until 2017.
Hanagatami? Yeah, the 2017 one. Damn, that has a cool poster. I mean, good for him, though. Yeah, but wow. No, the poster, his last poster is for Labyrinth of Cinema, as well as the very last movie, is amazing. Like, the color palette on it is awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I actually want to watch these two just to see kind of where he ended up. I mean, obviously, he must have found a fair amount of success if he continued making movies up until, you know, this past decade. Like...
Oh, apparently House was a huge hit with kids in Japan, which, much to the distress of the studio, which was like, we don't want this to be a hit, because then we have to figure out how to make more movies like it.
Wow. That's an interesting character.
It is interesting that it was a hit. I mean, at some level, it's like, oh yeah, okay, all right. And it's, I think, getting a little bit meta on it or whatever. You know, it almost feels like the how the youths watch stuff these days, where it's all the little 2 and 3 minute things that aren't really jointed, and they're all, everyone's trying to be crazier than the next person. And it's almost like, oh, well, here's a film of that from the 77, where, oh, you've got this segment. Check out this thing. It's crazy. All right, cool. Check out this. Oh, man, that's so dumb. All right, next thing.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, it makes nearly no sense in isolation, but makes a lot of sense when you look at it in the context of where comedy on film was at that time.
And again, like, doing interesting stuff, like with the stop motion and the even animating over the frames. There's some pretty cool stuff, like when Oshade's face in the mirror or whatever, it gets all like glass and shatters. Or that was some pretty cool stuff. I don't think that the blue screen stuff hit as well, but...
Reminded me of a mix of, you know, the way that Monty Python mixed live action and animation in their Flying Circus stuff.
Probably one of those things, too, of using what you have, technology and knowledge and budget and everything you have at the time as well, too, to be like, okay, we can do something here. I have to say, I do love that whenever Kung Fu goes into Kung Fu mode, you get Kung Fu music that goes on, too. So you're like, all right, we're about to have some Kung Fu time now.
Honestly, Kung Fu's Lamp Legs is one that'll stick in my head.
What the?
Like, the legs sticking later? Out of the lamp. Yeah.
At the very, last scene. Yeah. Hey, at least she went down fighting, right? Like, the others all got kind of, like, caught or trapped. At least she went down, you know.
You know, that end fight where she got eaten by the lamp thing. Like, it was such a crap deal. The other two are there, they're like, oh, you better fight, Kung Fu, keep going. I know you're being electrocuted to death and eaten by the house, but you keep fighting. We're gonna sit here and do nothing. You fight. You got this.
Well, Melody kind of liked it, right?
Melody had been like, she had been like bitten by the house by that time, so she had already been taken over and was like on the house side most of the time anyways. At least that's my interpretation. She was kind of like egging them on to make them be better house food or whatever.
I do love the ridiculousness of the piano kill.
Yeah, that piano one was great. Was pretty interesting, and I would say the most uncomfortably violent one. Well, uncomfortably and also hilariously violent one, just because, like, the slow dismemberment.
Yeah, and weirdly sexual, which was...
Yeah, strange. Yeah, there was definitely some of that in the movie that was a little bit... felt very of the period, let's just call
it. Yeah, yeah. Extended gratuitous nudity. Definitely wanted to show the nipples whenever they could. That was interesting. But, like... horror film wise, like, that's also not entirely out of the genre, right? That's very in theme, on brand, I should say.
Like, there's nearly all the, particularly at that time, like 77, like, when did Halloween come out? Was that 78?
78, I think.
78, you are correct.
Yeah, so that was actually before Halloween, which was really, I think, the first of those that got Began had that, and like they all those ones in there, they usually have some boobs in them, and they have some underwear and some, you know, they have some naughty bits to keep the teens coming back.
Yeah.
I was trying to figure here how old was she at the time? 59, 77,
18.
Yeah.
Are talking about Jamie Lee Curtis?
No, Oshare. Oh, like, how old was she? Like, how old was she in the movie? She was about 18 when they filmed that. Yeah, I was curious on the with the nudity stuff there, like how old the actors were, like, at the time when they did that. I'm like, I don't know. I mean, there's always different rules and things and stuff there, but
oh yeah, especially Japan in the 70s.
Yeah, I'm like rules. Yeah, very different rules.
Wow, she's got some heritage to her, the Oshare's actress. Kimiko Ikegami, born in New York, her closely related to some Kabuki family. Interesting. So, yeah, I guess we're pretty much here at the end of our time, but do you people, anybody have any final thoughts about the movie, things they want to share?
So I was talking about his campaign to get the movie made, so I guess I can talk a little about that.
Yeah, do tell.
So he was tasked with, you know, Japan's answer to Jaws, came up with this weird screenplay. Apparently it was greenlit in like 3 hours, which basically never happened in Japanese cinema in the 70s, but then went nowhere because no director wanted to be attached to it, because they're like, how the fuck am I going to make this crazy crap? And he wanted to make it, he's like, okay, so let me make it himself, but they're like, well, Toho doesn't, you know, like to work with outside directors. And he's like, well, can I at least say that I was greenlit by Toho on my business cards? And they're like, yeah, okay, you can say that. So then he starts, you know, like, manages to get this made in the time between the green light and the movie being made and coming out, like, get it made as shoujo and shonen manga, a radio drama, the soundtrack album pre-made in advance, and then, like, and, you know, get people who were fans of his art films like a decade earlier talking about it. So eventually the studio couldn't, you know, stop answering the question of when is this coming out, and had to actually let him make it.
He just bullied them into it, basically, huh?
Yeah,
That's some guerrilla marketing there, you know?
Yeah.
And it was successful, you know? Turned it into a big, long, successful career for him.
Wikipedia says critically panned, but the audience liked it, so... Rotten Tomato rotten score, but a fresh audience score.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. He said, like, his generation didn't get it at all. The theaters were absolutely packed with kids under 15, and, like, people 20 years older than him, like, understood what he was going for and got it.
But, older than him?
Yeah, like, we're like, we see some of the new innovative stuff you're doing and we respect that.
Oh, like, that's interesting. Huh.
That's very surprising, considering 1970s Japan and just Japanese elderly culture in general. So,
yeah.
Huh. Whoa, this is wild. He did a movie adaptation of Kazuo Umeza's Drifting Classroom.
Oh, what?
1987, 10 years after the manga finished.
Wow.
I want to watch that just because that's That's a big property. Like, that's a big deal.
That's a cool manga. It's a really good, just a side thing. If you haven't read that manga, it's up on the, you can get nice paper copies. I don't have that, but it is in the Viz manga app. It's really good. It's really interesting. Yeah. It's wild.
I've been wanting to read that, so I'm going to go check that out.
Yeah, it's definitely worth reading.
Well, I guess since you're talking now, do you have anything else you want to say about the movie, Dylan?
I'm just trying to, think like, okay, would I recommend this film? I think I would. I think I'd recommend it like as a film thing. Like if you give a cat like, hey, do you want to watch like a crazy experimental, unwatchable, very watchable film that's interesting? And if someone's like, okay, I'm interested, then I'd be like, totally watch this thing. It's cool. Would I recommend it to anyone just like, hey, do you want to watch a cool film from 1977 that totally makes sense and is reasonable and not ridiculous? I'd be like, no, you do not want to watch this movie. But it's got too many it's got too much fun stuff in it to give it a pan. And I think that's why it's gotten kind of this cult following. And I can definitely see why bunch of young kids were filling up the movie theaters at the time. They're like, hey, here's something that's cool and totally stupid at the same time. And that's pretty much what teens and preteens and stuff want. Plus there was some boobage. So, you know.
That's true, yep. And once they hear that, they don't need to hear anything else. Nick, how about you? Anything, final thoughts on the movie?
Yeah, just, I'm very impressed with, I've you know, since we started talking about Obayashi, the director, I've been looking through his wiki page, and man, this guy worked pretty dang hard. I mean, he released a ton of movies. I mean,
it is an interesting thing. It's one of the few Wikipedia pages, if you go to the Japanese version, it's like incredibly long.
Yeah, I think he was a very celebrated director because he's there's a lot of references material for him, so.
Yeah, no joke. There's tons of stuff in Japanese on here about him. Wow.
So he must be incredibly celebrated, at least, or have a very, very diehard following that wants to, you know, keep his information up to date. So I personally will probably look for some of his newer films to see how he changed. Or, you know, developed.
Should try and find the, like, what's maybe considered one of his best of the modern movies. And
Hanagatami is probably it. That's his second to last one, because it has, like, a 92% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh.
So, and I'm assuming it's actually more, like, directly correlated with World War II, so I'm assuming it's going to be the one. It's going to be his Princess Mononoke, so to speak.
Right.
But that poster looks rad. Like that is art is amazing. So yeah. You know, I didn't love House. I liked parts of it, and I think I get what it was trying to do. It's just I think from an era perspective, I'm just not the target audience, right? Like I was born 40 years too late. Yeah, I mean, was it worth watching once? Definitely. Would I recommend it? Depends.
Yeah.
Less likely, but I think it frames the ability to tell a cool story. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, that's about it.
I think maybe through the course of discussing this movie, I've kind of slightly shifted my opinion. I think both Dylan and Nick, you guys have given some good framing that it's like, I'm not going to recommend this to somebody to watch as a movie, but like, if I would say it's worth watching, you know, with these caveats, right? Like, you're not watching a movie that's for its plot. You're kind of watching the whole package of what it represents for film, I think, and a lot of the things that it was trying to do. Which I think that there's some worthwhile stuff in there. I definitely parts in there that I thought were really cool. And I think it deserves credit for that. So
it's
not watchable, but something that should be watched by some people. Anyways, next time we will be watching, or rather discussing, Satoshi Kon's Millennium Actress to complete the full film set of Satoshi Kon. So watch that. It is on Crunchyroll, right? Did we determine that?
Correct.
Yeah, so you can watch Millennium Actress on Crunchyroll, and then you'll be prepared to talk. To listen to us talk about it next time. And with that, this is Amo Kenzoku signing off. Saraba.